Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues. And one of the things we're going to be talking about is hypermobility. Are you hypermobile? Well, maybe you know and maybe you don't. We'll find out as we talk with our two guests today, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see you.
It's great to be here. Nice walk down in the sunshine today.
Yeah.
And you didn't slip and fall?
I did not. I was very careful, though.
That other voice was Lori. Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Laura, good to see you as well.
It is awesome to be here.
And as you listen to these two experts talk, I hope you'll think about maybe hypermobility. Do you have a concern about it? What physical therapy questions do you have? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, I think we kind of know sort of generally what hypermobility is. You're
loosely.
Joints.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, such a punster.
Loosely.
So
loosely
early.
We know what
hypermobility is. Oh, that went right over my head.
Oh. Ay.
Well, what's the medical term? Is it loosely? Or?
No, it's not loosely. Actually, it is hypermobility. That would be the medical term. So the not medical term is double-jointed. People talk about being double-jointed, and technically there is no such thing as being double-jointed. So, you know, we often tend to focus on people who have limited joint mobility, and we work on stretching and joint mobilization techniques and other kinds of manual therapy to help increase their mobility around a joint. But the other end of that continuum is being too mobile. And as a healthcare provider, I think I'd rather treat somebody who has hypomobility or too little motion at a joint than too much, because it's really hard to rein in that extra motion. It can lead to all kinds of secondary problems.
What causes it, by the way? Is it a genetics kind of thing, or is it?
That's an excellent question. And there is a type of hypermobility that does have a genetic component to it. The Ehlers-Danlos syndromes have a genetic component to them, and it can be identified genetically. Those people typically not only have musculoskeletal issues with their joints, but also have some sort of systemic issues, whether it's a cardiovascular issue, whether it's postural hypotension, so then when they stand up, they don't have enough compression distally to pump the blood back to their heart and they get lightheaded. So they have multiple complaints. Then there is the type that is just kind of musculoskeletal.
Yeah,
one of the caveats about the Ehlers-Danlos, recently the experts got together and they created a new language of hypermobility to provide some clarity to it and to make sure that people who were hypermobile but who didn't fit the classification for Ehlers-Danlos still got treatment. One of the things to note is that the many subtypes of Ehlers-Danlos that exist, and Jill alluded to those, the vascular type, there's a type that affects your eyes, and so on. The type that is just joint hypermobility has no genetic test.
Huh.
So it is the one where they cannot find, at this point in time, the genetic defect that causes it. So what they'll do is they'll rule out the other types of Ehlers-Danlos if you fit the classification of Ehlers-Danlos, and right now there are very specific criteria to meet that. But you wouldn't bother going to see the geneticist because there is currently not a genetic identifier for that. So that's the Ehlers-Danlos hypermobility type. Then on the other hand, you have what they call hypermobility spectrum disorder, and that is people who have different patterns of hypermobility in their joints. Some have what they call generalized joint hypermobility that hits multiple joints. Some have localized, and that may be just one or two joints that, for example, if they had an injury to a joint, or maybe they just have shoulder instability, but they don't have hypermobility anyplace else. So there's different classifications of hypermobility spectrum disorder. And those generally involve primarily the joints, but there can be other secondary conditions that are associated with it, but not caused by it.
I can see where treating somebody hypomobile would be. You can loosen them up, but then how do you tighten? How do you go the other way? That's got to be a problem.
So the challenge is, you're absolutely correct. So if patients who are hypermobile can't use their, what we call their static structures to support their joints, so that connective tissue, the ligaments, the capsules, things like that that we think of as being non-contractile structures that support the joint, then they rely on their muscles. And so these are the people who have to use their muscles all day long to stabilize and support their joints. So as you can imagine, by the end of the day, these people have incredible muscular fatigue. If they're using their muscles improperly, it can cause other issues such as headaches in the upper extremity. And it's often misdiagnosed as conditions such as fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome. And these things can go hand in hand. But the appreciation is many times these patients, no one has put all these points together to realize that they do have hypermobility, and they just, no one's put the pieces together that all these joints are truly linked.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they end up getting they put in these other buckets for treatment, but no one ever treats the underlying hypermobility.
And treating it, is it an issue then of strengthening particular muscles, or how do you treat?
Right. We work on strengthening in ways that doesn't over fatigue them. We work on energy savings, like how can you move during the day? How can we position you to save energy so you're not working so hard? We talk about braces, supports, splints, things like that, other devices to help unload the muscles and provide a little bit more static support to the joints.
John in Madison has something relating to this, so let's go there and see what's on John's mind. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hey, morning. Thanks for taking my call. I got a quick question. I'm really hypermobile through my back. I don't know if there's an extra vertebrae there, but I've always been this way, you know, can bend way down, touch way past my toes. But it's caused some back issues, and my mom is the exact same way. So I know when you started, you were talking kind of about, you know, different generations or, you know, having something family related. But I'm just wondering, is there some way that I can strengthen my back or some exercises to do to help with this? Because it does cause some back issues, I know for me and for her as well.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that's important about the genetic piece that we talked about, while there's not a genetic test for Ehlers-Danlos hypermobility type, realize that you do inherit your connective tissue from your parents. So although it's not passed on by a specific gene, you do inherit the quality of your connective tissue from your parents. So there is a familial component to it, we'll call it, rather than a genetic component.
Okay.
So yes, there are things you can do. I would, you know, this is going to come as a surprise to you. I would suggest that you see a physical therapist and be examined, because you may have hypermobility elsewhere that needs to be addressed. It's also possible that you have hypomobility in some places. So it would not be unusual to be hypomobile in your hips, and that is compensated in your back by hypermobility. So sorting that piece out would be important. And thereafter, there are a number of exercises that you can do to strengthen your back. So absolutely, it's really important, particularly in your core, for your back, that you have a strong back and that you control that hypermobility. Otherwise, we end up seeing people with scoliosis and things like
that.
What
would a physical therapist do? How would a physical therapist determine all that?
So they would do an examination, and we can actually examine the mobility level by level in the joints.
Oh.
And we would see if, for example, in John's case, if his spine was excessively mobile, we would look at the joints adjacent and particularly his hips. And if they're lower on kind of the spectrum or hypomobile, what we can do is we can actually, quote unquote, steal motion from those, increase the mobility in his hips so he doesn't have to use his spine quite as much, and then offer some stabilization exercises for his back. Now, having said all of this, this is truly a lifelong style for people. This is not something that is a quick fix. We're not going to change their hypermobility. We're going to teach them how to manage it. So these are people who will be doing exercises throughout their life.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And possibly changing as time goes along.
Correct. Yes. Absolutely. Right. Many people come and need a tune-up.
Right. A lot of it has to do with education. We're educating them on the movement. We're right. watching how they move. We're showing them how they move. And then teaching them how to move in ways that doesn't irritate a hypermobile joint.
John, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Linda in Baraboo next. Linda, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a violin student who's quite young. She's 6 years old, and she seems to be enjoying it. She's very talented, very bright, you know, has a good sense of pitch, et cetera. But she does have so-called double joints.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering over the long term if this is a good activity for her.
That's a great question. And I would encourage the student to be examined by a physical therapist, because there may be postural changes that would prevent her from getting injured. And you kind of have to decide when she plays the violin, which joints are involved. So if the joints that she uses to play the violin are involved, she can be doing appropriate strengthening exercises, activity modifications that help her. So I wouldn't necessarily just say immediately give up the violin. I would have her see a physical therapist to make sure that she can manage her condition.
I agree with that. So there are many people who play instruments and very successfully with hypermobile joints. And what we do is we work with them really over the course of their lifetime as they grow and develop on how to use their muscles, how to position themselves. You know, is your elbow high or low? How do you hold your string, your bow? And then we work on counterbalancing the muscles that they're overusing when they play the violin to make sure they have stability on the other side.
You know, the interesting thing with all of this is form somewhat follows function. So, for example, people who dive or do gymnastics need a lot of motion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so people who have hypermobility might actually be drawn to that activity, that sport, something like that. And it's not until the load or the volume goes up so high that they start having problems. So it's somewhat of a double-edged sword. So in my profession, in my world, in athletics, we see a lot of athletes who come in who are able to manage their condition throughout high school just fine. But then once the volume increases, they start having trouble. So to get in front of this, per se, with the individual who plays a violin would be an excellent strategy.
Yep, agreed.
Linda, does that help out?
I think that is helpful. In fact, I think the student and her mother may have the Ehlers-Danlos hypermobility?
Oh, Ehlers-Danlos.
How's that spelled, please?
Ehlers-Danlos.
Do it once more.
Ehlers-Danlos.
L-O-S. Okay. And what is the contact information for the clinic? Your clinic for is it the spine, UW Spine Stabilization?
Spine Physical Therapy. Yes. If Jill wants to take your contact information, we can get that to you.
Well, thank you so much.
All
thank
right.
you.
Thanks.
You bet.
Jill will grab that contact information.
Yeah. So one of the things about Ehlers-Danlos and all the subtypes of Ehlers-Danlos is they're classified as a syndrome. And what that means is there is a genetic defect that they, not in the hypermobile type, but in all the other types, that they can find. And it creates a whole host of problems. So, you know, if this young girl actually has Ehlers-Danlos, it will have symptoms and problems beyond just the hypermobility. So these people are often have gut issues. They have irritable bowel syndrome. There are a number of psychosocial conditions that travel with this. So if there is a consideration that someone does have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, they should be seen because they need to get ahead of the other, what we call comorbidities that go along with Ehlers-Danlos.
Right. It's all connective tissue. And so these syndromes impact all connective tissue. So it's not just musculoskeletal.
Right.
Linda, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues with our two guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. We started on hypermobility, and we're still taking questions about it, but also other physical therapy questions as well. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rochelle in Madison up next. Rochelle, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a pain in my heel that I don't know if it's plantar fasciitis or not. I've had it before, but I've never had it in the back of my heel. It's not on the bottom of my heel. It's like right between the Achilles tendon where it feels like there's a knife poking in there. And I don't know if it could be plantar fasciitis or something else.
So it's in the back of your heel, kind of where your Achilles comes down and attaches to your heel bone?
Yeah, it's like right between right between the Achilles tendon.
So there's a big bursa that sits back there, your retrocalcaneal bursa. Can you correlate, or do you feel there's some sort of activity you did, Rochelle, that kind of triggered this?
No, I mean, it started hurting in the fall, and I tried to ignore it for a long time, and it didn't go away.
Right.
I tried to take it easy and not exercise very much, but it felt a little better. But then when I started walking again, it came right back. And then I read about it, and I read about the bursitis, so I started taking the anti-inflammatories, and I immediately felt relief when I started taking anti-inflammatories. But maybe I quit taking them too soon because it felt better for a little while, and then, you know, like several weeks, and then I started exercising again, and then it came back again. And I don't know if it's, you know, could I do something with my shoes or inserts or exercises, or should I see PT, or should I get an X-ray, or how does one go about?
Oh, that's a lot of
questions.
Those are all good questions. That's a lot of questions. So does it hurt right on the tendon, or does it hurt, or is it between the tendon and the bone?
It's kind of between the tendon and the bone. It almost.
Okay.
For a while, I felt like I had broken maybe a bone or something back there.
Hmm. Well, it could be the bursitis. It could be, but it's not right on the bone, because we're trying to distinguish: is it a bursitis or is it a tendonitis? So that's why you would go see a physical therapist, so that they could poke around, do some different testing, and determine if it's a tendinopathy or if it's a bursitis. And then they would look at your foot and ankle and say, well, huh, why does Rochelle have this on one side and not on the other side? If you're walking and you're doing the same thing with each leg, is there some underlying problem that caused you to have this? So if you're walking on a road, sometimes it's because of the cant of the road. Sometimes it has to do with your work and what you do in your work and how you stand or move or how you use your ankles in your vocation as well.
And it's also, you had mentioned you had plantar fasciitis on this foot. So she may have some sort of muscle or soft tissue imbalance already that caused this kind of cause and effect. So I would say you've had two kind of injuries that you've tried to self-manage on this foot. And so it's impeding your activity. So I would definitely say it's time to see a physical therapist. You're really good with your history. You took medication and it made a change. Those are all good things to tell your PT, but I think it's time to see somebody.
Right. If it was going to get better on its own and some anti-inflammatories, it would have. So the other piece of advice just in general is if you take time off and you're doing this anti-inflammatory and so on, when you go back to activity, you can't go back at the same level you were at before. You have to work your way back into it slowly. So that's another strategy that people should use if they do take time off due to an injury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There you go, Rochelle. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Heather in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was just listening while I was having lunch here at the People's Food Co-op and heard you talking about Ehlers-Danlos, and I, 2 years ago, was diagnosed as well as my 71-year-old mother and my son. Oh. So we all three have it. And so we were diagnosed by a geneticist.
Yes.
Yep.
And so I just...
What kind did they diagnose you with? Is there a certain subtype?
The hypermobile type.
The hypermobile type. Okay.
Yeah.
And how, what were your symptoms? What took you to see a geneticist?
I had had chronic pain my entire life. Joint pain, hip pain, just everything. Bad teeth, poor gum tissue, dizziness, which now I know is POTS.
POTS, yep.
We didn't do that to that. So for a long time, I had all these symptoms, and I think for a long time, the doctors just thought I was depressed, and that's what I was told
right,
a lot.
Right, exactly. That's the misdiagnosis.
And so I had a back surgery, which I still never had,
right.
That kind of put it into a, you know, a flare, if you will.
Yes. Yep, yep.
Things just continued to get worse, and I lost a bunch of weight. And I actually had an MRI, which showed a little spot in my brain with iron deposits, which led me to a neurologist to notice my joint hypermobility, who sent me to a geneticist, and we went from there. So I just turned 40, and I'm just 2 years into my diagnosis. And
wow, yeah. So it was a neurologist who picked it up.
Mm-hmm. He picked it up.
Wow. So was there, I've not heard of the iron deposit in your brain. Did your neurologist think that was associated with the EDS?
He did not.
Okay. All right. All right. All right.
Random thing just because of the technology being so
right.
Sure. Much.
Okay. So some interesting things about that. The chronic pain, you know, Heather's story is so classic for what I see. The people who come to us often been diagnosed with chronic pain or fibromyalgia. And so when they go to see any provider with a pain complaint or something else, they tend to be told, well, it's just your fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. It's just your fibromyalgia, and nobody looks deeper. So, you know, the POTS is all part of it. Pelvic and bladder dysfunction is part of it. But even the depression and anxiety. So if you had all these symptoms and people
right.
told you, well, there's nothing wrong with you, would you not be anxious and depressed?
Correct.
So clearly those psychological conditions tend to run with this as well.
Can I ask how old your son is? You said your son was also diagnosed with it?
Yep. My son is 8.
He's
so
8.
So he was actually diagnosed when he was 6 and a half.
Okay.
So, and my daughter actually has an appointment next month.
Oh, great.
For to be assessed. So,
okay.
And we see a geneticist who diagnoses, but then we have other doctors that treat.
So it's too bad that he has it, but good that it was found at that
right.
age.
Absolutely.
So how are they managing that, or what are you? What's your treatment plan for you and your daughter and your son?
My treatment plan is physical therapy when I need it. A lot of times I go in for dry needling.
Okay.
I have a lot of neck pain, and they go in and do the dry needling and then turn on the electrical stimulation.
Yep.
So that helps. Diet is important. Resting mm-hmm. is important. I would say the number one thing for me is sleep. If I don't sleep, mm-hmm. my pain is worse. Everything is worse. When you get diagnosed with Ehlers, they automatically do an echo.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
for cardiac
yes.
conditions, yep. correct.
Right. Yep. And so they found out that I had a bicuspid valve, which I would never found out if I hadn't been diagnosed. So I have to take metoprolol. For that, but that's also helped my POTS syndrome because
yeah, sure.
my heart rate was high all the time. And I told doctors for years, I'm like, my heart rate is so fast. Right. And finally a doctor said, well, let's give you a beta blocker and see what it does. And it has helped me so much. So,
wow. And when she mentioned POT, when you mentioned POT, what is POT?
It's postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. So what happens is a change in posture, typically going from sitting to standing, people become tachycardic because of the extensibility in your capillaries and lower extremity doesn't push blood back up to your heart enough, and you become lightheaded and dizzy when you do those transitional changes.
Right, and your heart rate increases trying to get blood to your brain, and so people have this fast heartbeat. That's tachycardia.
Which is exactly what Heather described.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the first things they do when they suspect somebody of having EDS is they'll do a tilt table test looking for POTS. Really, thank you for sharing your story, Heather, that it's really nice to hear from someone who has that lived experience of what it's like to have hypermobility. I'm sure that was really useful for other listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And good luck to you and your family.
Right.
Thank you very much for calling. And, well, let's take another call. Kurt in Oak Creek is up next. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you very much. My wife is 59. She plays indoor volleyball, and the day after she can barely walk, it takes about a day, and then everything is fine and perfectly well. Now, she has noticed that one of her toes on that foot will not straighten out, and we're wondering what type of stretching she might try or something to help alleviate the problem.
Is it her second toe, Kurt?
She did not specify to me.
Okay.
But I can find that out. But,
okay. Because there is, if you have an irritation or partial rupture of your plantar fascia, it can actually change the line of pull, and it can do that. So if you have a plantar fascia irritation, that could be part of that.
So it's foot pain that she has where you say she can barely walk. What is it?
Yes.
Okay.
When she gets out of bed the next day, she has to, she limps for probably a good half an hour.
Okay. And what about the day after that? Does she have foot pain first thing when she gets out of bed every day, and it's just worse after playing volleyball, or is it?
Yes, it's only after the volleyball.
Okay.
So does she normally do any other impact type activities or anything where she's moving in multiple directions on a court?
Not on a court, just at work. She does a lot of carrying and moving.
Okay.
And it seems to be volleyball.
Okay.
Is the pain on the bottom of her foot or behind her foot and the ankle? Do you know?
On her heel.
On her heel. Okay. Well, you know, there are a couple possibilities with heel pain. One is, as Jill suggested, plantar fasciitis. Typically, that would continue to hurt you even on days when you're not playing volleyball. So it sounds like it's something more acute. There's also a fat pad underneath your heel, and it could be that all the impact from playing volleyball really irritates that fat pad. There's also a little nerve that travels in there, and that can get inflamed from a lot of impact. So in terms of treatment, I would, when she gets home from volleyball, I'd have her ice the bottom of her foot, do a little bit of stretching for her calf and her plantar fascia where she pulls her toes back and try some of that. Make sure her shoes are in good shape. And if she's still having a lot of trouble, she should go in and have it looked at so they can get an accurate diagnosis and get you on the right treatment path.
Right. The other thing is many people, there's an association between plantar fasciitis and tight gastroc, and if she does a lot of jumping that night, her calves may be getting tight, and that may be somehow impacting her plantar fascia. And it could be her fat pad, and if it is, then we would recommend a heel cup. So it would definitely be worth seeing a physical therapist for one or two visits to get this under control. They may make shoe recommendations, shock absorptive soles, inserts recommendations, and then, like Lori said, a management program so you can manage it.
Yeah.
Because you want to keep playing volleyball.
Right, you got to keep playing volleyball.
Absolutely.
Indeed. Yeah, it's and eventually fun. it'll spill over into her daily activities.
Correct, yeah.
Kurt, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Arlene in La Crosse, we turn to you next. Hi, Arlene.
Hi, Hi, good afternoon, or good morning, I guess. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. A number of years ago, I had a very successful rotator cuff surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And about a year ago, I developed more pain in that shoulder, but it was an unusual pain. So I went to see the surgeon. He did an MRI, and he said, unfortunately, you have a calcium deposit, you know, in the site of the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of was the end of it. I mean, I did a little therapy on it, but it's still very painful. And I was just wondering, is there anything, any intervention to dissolve a calcium deposit?
So this is classically called calcific tendonitis in the shoulder. And unfortunately, we don't know why people get it versus some people get it, some people don't. Mm-hmm. Some people have had surgery and get it. Some people have had surgery and don't get it. I anecdotally was told by a patient that it was the most painful thing she had ever experienced. She said it was awful. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to manage because now you have this, for lack of better terms, this bony laying down of tissue in a muscle that shouldn't be there. So it's basically a mechanical block, if you will. It used to be anecdotally that we used to try
ultrasound
and phonophoresis with
iontophoresis
with acetic acid, which is Heinz distilled vinegar.
Yeah.
And that used to help break it up. There's not really any evidence behind it to support that. But anecdotally, people used to say it helped. I don't know where current literature is on it. I haven't seen anything that supports it at this point.
Yeah, nor have I.
Very little to help with it. Over time, typically your body will reabsorb that calcium. It'll realize it laid down calcium in a place where it shouldn't be, and it will reabsorb it. But it does take a fair amount of time.
But from a physical therapy standpoint, not much, right?
Not much, you
know,
be done. Right?
No. We try to strengthen around it and try to help, you know, with muscles to substitute and take over if it's really bothering you. But there's nothing we do to treat the calcium deposits themselves.
And when you say over time, are we talking a year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. A couple of years. And it's more common in women than men, and we don't know why that is either.
Yeah.
So
there you go, Arlene. Thank you so much for calling. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Chris in Milwaukee, let's go to you next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I had surgery in October for colon cancer, and it entailed the removal of my abdominal muscles on the right side of my body, and then the colostomy was put through on the left. Since then, I've been very tired and weak, not the same as I was. I'm not able to do what I used to be able to do. Is there anything I can do to kind of alleviate that and to just build myself up again? I do have a 50-pound weight limit.
Mm. Yeah, right. So did you see anyone after your surgery in terms of therapy and getting your strength back and getting your mobility back?
Yes, I did. I was given the bands, like the rubber bands.
The TheraBands,
okay.
And also just did some, you know, like the kicks and the leg exercise.
All right. Are you able to do those?
I can do those, yes.
Okay.
I haven't been doing a lot of them. They don't seem to be doing anything.
Right. Okay. I think those sound like really nice generalized strengthening exercises for you, Chris. And I'm wondering if Chris needs more of a specific core, low back, kind of lumbopelvic rehab program.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. It sounds like the standard stuff you would get post-operatively to help maintain general strength in your large muscle groups to help you with your walking, to get in and out of a chair, to go up and down stairs and things like that. So it was a fairly general program to help get you back on your feet. But now you're in another phase, and now it's time to work specifically on the things that were addressed in your surgery. So we need to start to funnel down to the specific areas where you're having problems yet post-op. So I would suggest going back to whoever you saw post-op, or if there's anyone in your area that specifically treats people through an oncology program, Or since it's abdominal muscles, I would either look at spine or women's health mm-hmm. to look at pelvic floor,
right.
because those people would be able to help you probably the most to start to tailor a program to your specific needs now and the deficits that remain post-op.
Right, I agree.
And you're in the Milwaukee area, so there should be plenty.
Absolutely. Should be plenty of people there.
Good luck, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. And Carlene in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Carlene.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have basal joint arthritis and CMC dislocation in my thumb. I've been to see an occupational therapist to prescribe some isometric exercises and a brace. But I'm wondering, I still have considerable pain, and I have to use my hands a lot, wondering when it's time to have surgery, since that's one of the things that everybody says to me, eventually you're going to need to have surgery.
Yeah. Right. That's a great question. So the CMC joint of your thumb is very special because it moves and it basically gives us the mobility that we have with our thumb. So it moves in multiple directions, multiple ways, and so it is more prone to arthritis. So I like your conservative management. You're doing some isometric exercises. You're bracing it so you're not overusing it. But I guess Lori's general rule is when the bad days outweigh the good, it's probably time to consider having surgery done.
Right. So it really comes down to your function and your pain. So one of the things to watch for, and is this both hands or one?
Well, it's both hands, but more so in my right hand.
And your dominant,
dominant.
Yeah. So things to watch for are an increase in elbow pain, shoulder pain, neck pain, which is a sign that you're starting to change how you move, change how you do things, and use other muscles. So you're starting to shift the workload from your thumb to the joints farther up your arm. And you don't want to wear those out. You don't want to end up with an elbow problem, a shoulder problem, a neck problem because of how you're using your wrist and hand.
And the other thing is you don't want your world to get smaller. So you don't want to start really letting go of activities you like to do. I hear you say that, you know, you need to use your hands a lot for work. So if you're using all of it for work and you don't get to do leisure activities or recreational activities that you enjoy, it's probably time to consider that.
And that's that surgery for your CMC joint is a pretty successful surgery.
Right, it's pretty good outcomes.
Our mother had it.
Yeah. After, because she had pain rolling out Christmas cookies, and you know for a fact that we want our Christmas cookies. So absolutely.
Yeah.
There you go, Carlene. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. And we'll go right back to our phones. Don in Madison has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I've got a new right hip, and 3 months now, I have a real weakness when I sit or stoop. The foot wants to rotate in, and I don't seem to have very much muscle strength to like fight that off. I'm wondering what sort of exercises I could do. I've got a physical therapist that gave me some exercises to do, but I'm wondering, they don't seem really to be addressing this particular issue.
So did you have an anterior approach or a posterior approach to your total hip replacement, Don?
I can tell you where the scar is.
So that sure.
Yeah.
Okay, it's on the side, like right over the trochanter.
Okay. Let me ask you this. What are your hip precautions?
Midline, 90 degrees.
So you had a posterior approach.
Okay. So that's very
helpful. A posterior approach. Okay.
So with a posterior approach, what they have to do is they have to either take down or cut through your gluteus medius muscle, which is it's a gluteal muscle on the side of your hip. And what it does is it does a couple of things, but one of the things it does external rotation. So I'm wondering if that's got some weakness. So the first thing I would do is go back to my physical therapist and ask if you have weakness in your gluteus medius, and get some very specific gluteus medius strengthening exercises. That is not uncommon. That is one of the downsides, if you will, of having a posterior lateral approach, is you have to go through that very, very important muscle. It does take a while to strengthen it, but you do want to make sure that you're doing exercises very specific for it. So gluteus medius is probably what you need to focus on.
Absolutely. So one of the things you can do is if you're, you know, lying in bed or something, and your legs are straight out, work on rotating your whole leg out. So if you think about your feet pointing straight up to the ceiling, squeeze your cheeks together and rotate your feet out. And if you do it on the other side along with this side, then it'll help teach that side how to do that external rotation and really focus on that. And when you're getting up and down out of a chair, really focus on getting your foot turned out and pushing down through your heel and squeezing that glute when you get up. You've got to use it all day long. You can't just use it during your exercise program or it's not going to get stronger.
Right.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Don, for calling. And Jim in Elm Grove will go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Thanks for taking it. I'm about 54. I think I somewhat injured a shoulder a couple of years ago. A ladder slipped, and I kind of reached and grabbed something that kind of yanked on my arm a little bit. And it's never really quite ever gotten totally better. I have kind of a dull ache in the backside. If I'm not doing much physical stuff, it's just kind of like that, maybe a little pain on the outer edge. But when I do physical stuff, like we just had all this snow and I'm out there doing snow blowing, shoveling, that kind of stuff, my bicep gets sore, the shoulder gets sore a little bit further. So I'm just wondering, what would you recommend as far as either some things I could do myself, or do I need to actually go in and see a doctor, a therapist?
Let me ask you this, Jim. When you fell and you grabbed the ladder, did you fall down and your arm got pulled up? Or how did that happen?
I grabbed something that was a little bit more like I was reaching over my head and it kind of yanked away from me. So it kind of pulled my shoulder up and away from my head, kind of in more of a vertical upward direction, more or less.
And have you noticed any like loss of muscle tone around your shoulder or shoulder blade at all?
Yeah, I can't say that I noticed that. It's just, it wasn't so bad right away. It got a little bit sore. I was rehabbing a house at the time. And
of course you were. Okay.
And so I had to keep working, and it got worse. Then it got better.
It could be a couple different things. It could be, you know, you could have a very small tear in your rotator cuff, which you would manage conservatively anyway. The fact that you said you use your biceps a lot, you could have had some sort of irritation to your labrum. Any of these things, the first line of defense is going to be conservative care. It would be very helpful to truly have a good diagnosis so you know what you're dealing with. But it's time to see a physical therapist. You tried to kind of piecemeal this together and you know, kind of ebbs and flows. But, you know, with your age, it sounds like you're very active. You're doing a lot of physical labor. It's time to make sure that you're on a really good, solid shoulder strengthening program and to keep your mobility.
Yeah, there is a good chance it's your rotator cuff. And as we age, your rotator cuff degenerates in everybody. And so if you are in a vocation where you're using your arm a lot, you're going to end up with, you know, a biceps tendinopathy. You're going to end up with neck pain. You're going to end up with a number of different things. things if your rotator cuff isn't doing its job properly and efficiently. So it's good that you called when you did, and a couple of visits can right. help get you on the track to strengthen your rotator cuff, and they can also rule out other possibilities that, you know, we didn't discuss today if there's some other problem that happened at the time you right. of your injury.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much, Jim, and good luck to you. Let's go to Twyla next in Milwaukee. Hi, Twyla.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about whether or not it would be good to go and see a physician about this. I've been having knee pain in my right knee only for a number of months. And I never have a problem, even though I walk 5 miles a day, I never have a problem when I'm up and around. It's at night. Sometimes the pain will wake me from sleep. And then I usually get up and sometimes I'll take an aspirin, a low-dose aspirin, or an anti-inflammatory of some kind, and then it seems to help. But it's a burning pain. It's felt mostly in the medial aspect of my knee, so I'm just wondering what, if anything, I can do about it, or do I need to see a physician and have an imaging of some kind?
Well, so any idea what brought this on?
No, it just appeared, and it happened, like I said, at night.
Okay.
And not every night.
So, Twyla, this is going to be probably a hard question to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you sleeping in a certain position on the nights that you wake up with pain? Is your knee or your hip or your back in a certain position consistently?
I am a side sleeper, and I was having some severe hip pain for a while, and then I got a new mattress, and now the hip pain is resolved. But I'm almost always on my side, either my right or my left. I do sleep with a pillow between my legs to keep my back.
Good. Okay.
Right? Because I do have issues with my back. I've always had that.
Okay.
But this knee pain is something new.
Okay.
Do you notice any relationship to your activity that day? If you've been up more or standing on a different surface or if you're just more active on the days that it starts to hurt? Is there any pattern to it?
No, I don't believe so, because I'm pretty consistent in walking either outside or inside on the treadmill for about 5 miles a day, and then I keep active most of the day. I'm up moving around. I don't sit a lot.
Okay. So it would probably benefit you to see a physical therapist because you've had this for a number of months, and it sounds like you're maintaining your activity level, but we certainly don't want this to impede that. My first thought is you have a nerve over there. It's called your saphenous nerve, which is on the medial side of your knee. It's pretty unusual to have an irritation there without having like an arthroscopic surgery or something like that over where you have some scar tissue on the medial side of your knee. So it'd be kind of unusual, but that's the first thing that comes to mind for me.
Yeah, that's possible. It could also just be some wear and tear on the inside of your knee. And it's not unusual for that to hurt more at night.
Right.
So, you know, you're moving during the day, and as you're moving, you're actually lubricating your joint surfaces with that walking and that moving around in your joint surfaces like that. But at night, when you stop moving and your joint is static, you don't get that lubrication, and that can start to create pain.
Yeah.
There you go, Twyla. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Daryl in Ashland a chance to join us. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, thank you.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, this is a question regarding my daughter. So she's 13 years old, and one of her feet, the bone on top of the foot, the bone that's prominent of the foot,
uh-huh.
She said that clicks when she walks, only when she's not wearing her shoes.
Okay.
So, I mean, she's pretty active in sports. She plays soccer and cheerleading and volleyball. So does the sports have something to do with that?
Is the clicking painful?
She said it does get sore.
Okay. All right.
Well, if she has the symptoms only when she's barefoot, my guess is that she has some excessive mobility in her midfoot, and it's not being supported because she's not in a supportive shoe. And so she's getting some shifting of those bones in there, probably more mobility than she should have. And the obvious answer is wearing shoes. and if it's not bothering her with her sports activities, then I'd encourage her to wear shoes and not go barefoot a lot. If she starts having symptoms from that, then she should be seen. She could have some hypermobility. We call it peripheral joint hypermobility. Usually it's in the hands and feet. So it could be some localized hypermobility in her feet that's treated with orthotic shoe wear, some foot strengthening, and so on.
There you go. Good luck, Daryl. Thank you so much. Ann emailed to ask if she should use heat or ice or both for a muscle strain, and how long should she treat?
So that's a great question. Typically, we use ice in the acute phases of a muscle strain, and acute can last anywhere from 24 hours to a week. So if people keep irritating it, I would definitely use ice. Heat can be used a little bit more in the chronic situation. That is totally fine. When in doubt, use ice. You can't go wrong with ice. The other thing is some people will use heat to warm up the muscle before activity and then use ice afterwards.
I've actually had someone on the show the other day a couple of weeks ago, who talked about ice as being used too much.
Right.
Because it inhibits the improvement of the body.
So there is that argument that your body needs to go through the inflammatory process.
Yes.
And if we take an anti-inflammatory medication or ice, are we stopping the natural process
right.
that the body has to go through? There is an argument for that.
Yeah, I don't think in general that the cold penetrates deep enough, depending upon the body part
right.
that you're working with, because the body's blood temperature regulation system is really good at dispersing the heat and the cool.
Well, we can talk some more about that, but we need to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Our guests today, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at physical therapy issues today. What's going on with you and your body? Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We've talked about hypermobility quite a bit, but taking some other issues as well. So again, call in 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And our guest, of course, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Dennis and Racine, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have chronic Achilles in both ankles, primarily the left ankle. An injury occurred 5 years ago and took 2.5 years to get diagnosed properly. They finally diagnosed it as a split tendon, not torn, but split tendon. So surgery took care of that pretty well 2.5 years ago, but it's been pain ever since on weight bearing and putting too much weight in the left foot. Rather, the opposite foot caused pain on that foot as well. So I'm not sure if it's even very serious. They say more recently that there's nothing wrong with those tendons, but it's very hard to walk since this happened. I've worn cam walkers on both feet for 5 years. I'm starting to get away from them, but there's still pain. And the physical therapy so far hasn't helped very much. Evidently, the tendons are unused to weight-bearing. They say they're fine, but there's also a lot of pain on weight-bearing, and I'm not quite sure what it is. I don't X-rays have shown nothing wrong. MRI, I haven't seen that yet, but recent one. But it looks like there's nothing wrong with those tendons, yet there's pain on weight-bearing. I don't know what to do about this.
So you had a split tendon on one side, and they repaired that? Is that what you said, Dennis?
I've done very successful surgery 2.5 years ago, but there's been pain and weight bearing on that foot ever since. I'm out of the opposite one. Began wearing cam walkers on both feet for a long time, and they say that that's the cause of the pain. I should stop wearing them. Huh. I'm not using them right now, but it's still hurting.
Okay.
So is the pain clearly in your Achilles tendon when you touch it, squeeze it, palpate it? It hurts right in the tendon?
There's some pain in the left tendon more than the right, the one that wasn't injured.
Right. But is that the place where it hurts when you say it hurts upon weight bearing? Is that where it hurts?
That's just the place in both tendons, especially the left one.
Okay. And what kind of physical therapy have you had? What kind of things have they done?
Recently they've done stretching and strengthening, like range of motion and things like that. Recently they were not using any modalities, just exercising, strengthening, using, riding a bike for a short time, stationary bike, and those kinds of things.
What kind of strengthening? How did they do the strengthening?
Well, they did exercises, stationary, but also walking back and forth.
Okay.
And also some, they call them, not a bench press. I mean,
leg press.
Leg press, correct, yep. Up to 30 pounds.
Okay.
I went to therapy for 4 or 5 weeks, it stopped, and then we'll continue until the doctor says so. So.
Did they do any eccentric type of exercises for your Achilles? Yes?
This therapy is not this time.
What is eccentric again?
Eccentric is the negative, the lowering. Are you doing things like toe raises up and down on your toes?
I've done that, and I think the press might be what you're talking about.
Okay. You're doing that just with your ankles, not with your legs? Okay.
No, just the leg, mostly the calf muscles are involved.
Okay.
All right. But you're using both feet and you're pushing down. You're going both directions. You're pushing and then lowering it as well?
That's what I did in the weight press.
Okay. And you're doing 30, 35 pounds, and does that hurt when you do it?
No.
Okay. All right. Great. So think about 30, 35 pounds as compared to your body weight. Okay?
Yeah.
So I think you're on the right track, but there's just a huge gap between where you're at in your strengthening and what you need to move your body weight.
Right.
So every time you take a step and your Achilles has to accommodate and then push off your entire body weight. So I think your leg press, you know, exercise that you're doing, your toe raises, really focusing on the lowering phase and increasing the workload on that could eventually get you there. But when you're talking about your Achilles tendon, you're talking about what we call dense connective tissue, and it is dense. It doesn't have a very good blood supply at all, and depending upon your age, the ability of the tendon tissue itself to recover and repair is fairly slow. So you've had surgery, you had a split tendon, it's going to take a long time to recover from this. So this is not something that's going to get better in 6 weeks or 12 weeks or, you know, 25 weeks. It's going to take a long time to get you there.
Right.
I don't necessarily agree with stopping the cam walker. What do you think, Jill?
Yeah, I feel like Dennis has had a lot thrown at him. So mm-hmm. I was struggling with that a little bit too. I think I would have transitioned from, if I'd have taken him out of the cam, I probably would have transitioned to a shoe with a very small heel lift.
Yep.
And made that transition and then eventually taken the heel lift out. It might have been too drastic of a change to go from a cam to a regular shoe. Mm-hmm. That was my thought.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you'll get there eventually, but I think you have to keep increasing the load on your strengthening. Mm-hmm. To keep
right.
moving forward.
Right.
That's my sense about it. And just being patient, because it is going to take a long time.
Correct.
The Achilles tendon is notoriously difficult to recover from because you use it every time you take a step.
Right.
Good luck, Dennis. And thank you so much for calling. Keep at it. Keep at it.
Yep.
Judy in Johnson Creek, we go to you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I had a right total knee replacement a year ago. And the knee itself is doing really good. But I just visited my doctor last week. And the problem is when I do a lot of walking, I start feeling a lot of pressure and heaviness along the top of that knee area. And it feels like it's swelling. And then it starts getting painful. And the doctor told me that what he can see is a thickening of tissue along that area above my knee. And maybe that's the reason I'm feeling this pressure and heaviness at the top of my knee there. And that might be why I feel uncomfortable when I start walking distances.
Yes, I have seen this in people who have had knee replacements or partial knee replacements, where above the knee, you can feel this thickened tissue. You have a small muscle up there called your articularis genu, which helps pull your kneecap up and pull some of the other soft tissue out of the way when you fire your quads. And I think in some people you get some scarring above your kneecap. So typically we do some manual therapy. There are physical therapists who use tools, things like ASTIM or Graston techniques, to get in there with some metal tools, actually, right, and really work that scar tissue to try to get that scar tissue to breaken up, to soften up, to increase its mobility so that you, so it helps deal with that sensation of that tightness and thickening there.
Right. And then you'd want to make sure you follow that up with a lot of quadriceps setting or quadriceps strengthening, because your patella needs to slide superiorly, needs to slide upward as you make a muscle in your quad. And so that would also help kind of increase the mobility in that area.
Yep, exactly. So that's what I'd do. I'd have someone look at it and get in there with some of these tools to help break up some of that scar tissue or soften that scar tissue so your kneecap can slide up like it needs to be able to do.
There you go, Judy. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling in. Craig in Rice Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Craig.
Hi there. See, a few weeks ago, I woke up with my left hand pinky and ring finger kind of tingling like I slept on it or something. And it isn't really going away, and I feel like I'm like my hand is getting a little weaker over time. Like it isn't going away.
Right. Yeah. So that could be coming from two different places. It could either be coming from your elbow, your ulnar nerve innervates those two fingers, or more than likely it's probably coming from your neck.
Yeah.
So if you slept funny or slept with your neck side bent a certain way and caused some compression on one of the nerve roots up there that goes all the way down to your hand, would be C7, that could be causing that irritation.
Yep. Or if you slept with your elbow bent. Yep.
Right.
And your wrist bent, then that can cause irritation across your elbow. So if you're starting to note weakness in your hand, you need to get in and get this looked at so can figure out the origin of the problem and treat the appropriate area. So it's your left hand. Are you right or left-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Okay, good.
My left hand.
Okay, so did you do anything different the day before? Anything with your neck or head, or have any neck pain?
Some self-diagnosis had me looking at that radial ulnar syndrome, I think they call it, on the internet.
And on the internet, Dr. Google.
Right.
I would go cubital tunnel syndrome before I'd go radial ulnar syndrome. I go cubital tunnel. That's kind of where your funny bone is. And if you bend your elbow all the way up and you kind of extend your wrist like you're holding a pizza tray, that will load that ulnar nerve. And if you slept in that position or put it in a prolonged position, held it there for a long time, can irritate that nerve. The nerve becomes anoxic. It doesn't get any oxygen. And then it becomes very angry. So if that's the case, if it's coming from your elbow, it would be cubital tunnel. If it's coming from your neck, it's probably a nerve root irritation at C7.
Right. Yep.
There you go. I'd have it looked at because those things would be managed very differently.
Very differently, exactly. Yeah.
Good luck, Craig. Thank you very much for calling. Amber in Tomahawk, let's turn to you next. Hi, Amber.
Hi. So here's my question for you. Like 17 or 18 years ago, I had cell palsy on the right side of my face.
Oh, sure.
It was completely paralyzed for 3 months and then slowly started to come back. And say I'm about 90% back.
She's breaking up. She's
like, I'll have maybe some toxin, maybe I'll accumulate a little saliva in the corner of my mouth or that eye of water, or the face always feels heavy.
Yep.
And then a few years after that, I had a brachial plexus injury also on the right side. And, I wasn't even able to write my name with a pencil or turn the car keys over in the car. Eventually that, I did do physical therapy after that and also exercises on my face after the Bell's palsy. So here I am many years later, and I'm still just, maybe like 90% after both those injuries. And I don't know if it's worth even, maybe I'm just lucky I'm where I am, or is it worth doing something at this point? Because, sometimes I'm right-handed and I use my play tennis and I get to do plenty with that side. But, sometimes I have to use my left hand to open a jar because I just don't have that same strength.
Right. Did the diagnosis with the brachial plexus on your right side, was that Parsonage Turner? Did they call it that?
No, they did not. They called it brachial plexus neuropathy.
Okay. Okay. So it sounds like you're at 90%, 17 to 18 years after these incidences. The question is, could you get a little bit more? Typically, our dominant hand is 10 to 15% stronger than our non-dominant hand. So I can understand how this deficit is impacting you.
What was the cause of the brachial plexopathy?
Really nothing. I just kind of reached up to grab something, felt that typical, yank thing, and didn't think much of it. And then over the course of about 4 days, I started to lose all control on that side.
So has someone looked at you for hypermobility? I mean, we started talking the show about hypermobility, but it's really unusual for someone to reach and injure their brachial plexus. So
yeah, nobody has, but I do think my daughter has some issues with that too, and I know that can be hereditary. So, maybe that could be.
Yeah, so I'd dig a little bit deeper. It's odd to have both the Bell's palsy and the brachial plexopathy in an otherwise healthy individual in the absence of, some clear injury. So, so I would take a look at that. Any other symptoms elsewhere?
No, it's just these two lingering things, but they're both on the right side, and they're just, it's a little annoying.
Oh, sure.
Not really have full control over, some parts of it.
Yeah. Right. Yes. So I'd kind of look at the hypermobility piece and see if there's something there that is preventing you from getting that last, 15% in your strength, and that would underlie both of these interesting conditions that you have.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck, Amber. Thank you very much for calling. Michelle and Viola, your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Excuse me. Hi. I have my talus bone and my ankle is dislocating. It started about 3-4 months ago. And I'm just curious what can cause that and what I should be doing for it.
So can you describe the dislocating a little bit more, Michelle? Does it truly come out of joint where you have to push it in, or does it just slide a lot, or tell us about that?
Nope, it is actually coming out. I can do some self-massage on it, and it takes anywhere from 2 seconds to 5 minutes to get it in. Once in a while, this morning, I soak it in warm water for about a half hour, and it seems to just relax it enough that I can coax it in then. Very rarely does it take that to do it, but when it happens, and it happens when if you are putting your shoe on and you let your foot drop, it will go out. If I let my foot drop, I have to hold it firm.
And, And this is
and
just
when it does, I cannot take a step on it.
Right. And this is just one ankle?
Yep, just one ankle.
Any idea why? Has this been your whole life or?
Nope, it's only been going on a few months. I've always had good, strong ankles, good, strong feet. I did fall this last summer twice in a hole and twist my ankle, but it wasn't even a bad twist. I mean, it was just, you know, get up, shake it off, and it's fine. So that was that is the only thing I can come up with that I have done in the past that could have caused this.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if there's some ligaments that run right across your ankle joint that when you fell in the hole, you injured, and that you, have you seen a physical therapist to get some?
Not yet. I
think that'd be a really good strategy for you to get some stabilization type exercises and get appropriate stretching and strengthening. It sounds like you found modifications in your range of motion and things like that. But if you keep dislocating, you're going to wear out the articular cartilage on that joint. And we certainly don't want that to happen.
So did you see a physician who made this diagnosis?
Not yet. Not yet.
Okay.
Because I quizzing different friends that are.
So back up. You need to see somebody and get an appropriate diagnosis. So neither Jill nor I can speak for you. Have never seen a Taylor dislocation in my life.
Ever.
So we need to find out what's really going on. So if you twisted your ankle and it didn't seem that bad, Jill is correct that you may have sprained some of the ligaments in the front of your ankle that stabilize your ankle joint itself. It's called your mortis joint, and it's really important that that joint is stable. So one of the first things I do is I would go have it looked at, and I would get some films.
I would get weight-bearing x-rays.
I get weight-bearing x-rays to rule out. Thank you. Well done.
A high ankle sprain?
High ankle sprain.
And an anterior tib fib joint.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to get in and get that done first and foremost. Make sure the films are weight-bearing. Do not let them take non-weight-bearing films.
Right.
And look at the stability of your ankle mortis.
Compare side to side. They should do weight-bearing of both.
Exactly.
Agreed.
So that would be my very first stop, especially your history last summer, especially if you stepped in a hole and plantar flexed and rotated. That's a classic mechanism for that.
Yep.
There you go, Michelle. Thank you so much for calling. Katie emailed, she has very flexible joints in her knees and elsewhere since she was a kid. She's now 71 years old, but about 5 years ago, she began to have very painful sensation of having her right knee pop out of position when she was sitting. An occasional thing has been diagnosed tentatively as an IT band issue. She says it feels more like part of her knee joint popping out of place. Often takes 30 seconds or so for it to pop back in, at which point the pain disappears.
Yeah, it sounds to me like she's probably got her patella is subluxing or dislocating, and it sounds to me like she's got some systemic hypermobility.
Yep, or it could be that she has a meniscus tear too. So when people say that their knee joint itself pops out, you're like Jill said, it could be a kneecap issue. Usually it's pretty clear when your kneecap dislocates. You can kind of see it out to the side, or you can see your kneecap kind of pop or make a sudden shift in its position, and then you know it's your kneecap. If it feels like it's deeper, more of a thunk or something like that, then it could be the meniscus, or it could be the joint itself by just if she's sitting and she's relaxed and her connective tissue is relaxed, she can get a little shift in the tibiofemoral joint itself. So she should have it looked at. It does not sound as an IT band issue in any way, shape, or form from the information that we have.
Right.
And on that note, we are out of time. Lori and Jill, thank you so much. You are going to be back on March 18th.
Yes. Awesome.
We'll do it all over again.
Sounds
great. Thanks.
Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. They'll be back March 18th, and we'll do this again with them. Tomorrow at 11, Sheila Mergane will be back to talk about how to increase love in your life. Then at 11:45, we'll look at food-related travel. So I hope you can join us for those two topics. But you know what? You better stay with us because there's lots more in store here this afternoon on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.